Good morning. So you know by now that our overarching theme for the year is called Building the House. And my message this Sunday is titled Transfigured by Love. And just to let you know in advance, I did something I don't normally do, which is make sermon notes, which are available on the app and in your bulletin. And because I'm not used to doing that, there's going to be a very clunky partway through where I'm asking you to write things way faster. The slides are going too fast for you to actually write down the answers that go in the things. So feel free to say wait or raise your hand or see me afterwards if you miss the answer. Not that they're critical or that you couldn't figure them out by yourself. All right, so I'm going to start. The second lectionary reading for this morning and also the passage for today's message is from Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 through 9. 6 days later, Jesus took Peter and the two brothers, James and John, and led them up a high mountain. As the men watched, Jesus' appearance changed so that his face shone like the sun and his clothing became dazzling white. Suddenly, Moses and Elijah appeared and began talking with Jesus. Peter blurted out, "Lord, this is wonderful. If you want me to, I'll make 3 tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." But even as he said it, a bright cloud came over them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, and I am fully pleased with him. Listen to him." The disciples were terrified and fell face down on the ground. Jesus came over and touched them. "Get up," he said. "Don't be afraid." And when they looked, they saw only Jesus with them. As they descended the mountain, Jesus commanded them, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until I, the Son of Man, have been raised from the dead." Anybody want to tell me what this event is called? Transfiguration, that's right. One of the things I really appreciate about the lectionary is that, you know, the passages are given for the morning. You don't get to choose. And there's a lot of benefit to that because I had to deal with a passage that I've read 1,000 times but never ever spent actual time with. So I had a lot of fun, and I hope you'll think it's fun, learning about what this passage can mean. So let me give you a bit of context before we look at the themes and the ideas and the images in the passage. First of all, this event appears in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and the details in each are very similar. In each of these 3 Gospels, the event takes place close to the end of Jesus' ministry. Maybe you recall the time when Jesus turned to his disciples and asked them, "Who do you say I am?" And they give a bunch of wrong answers, including saying he's the prophet Elijah. And then Peter answers, "You are the Messiah." Well, a little bit after that time, Jesus tells them he's going to go to Jerusalem, where he will be rejected by the religious and the secular leaders, and that he's going to be tortured and put to death. And then Peter shouts out, "No way, this is not going to happen." And Jesus very sternly corrects Peter. "No, Peter, you're seeing things from a human point of view, not from God's view." And then a few days after that event, the transfiguration happens, which Peter, James, and John witness. And then just a few weeks after that, Jesus enters Jerusalem, where what he predicted about his death comes to pass. So we could say that this event, the transfiguration, recorded in 3 of the Gospels, is a transition point or hinge or threshold between 2 questions that the Gospels answer. Okay, here's the clunky part where the slides have trouble keeping up with me. The first half of the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke answer the question, "Who is Jesus?" And the answer, as Peter rightly said, is, "He is the Messiah." The second half of the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke answer a different question. What kind of Messiah is he? And this is what the disciples will discover. So the transfiguration is the event, the hinge, the transition, the threshold between the two questions and their answers. Okay, if I keep going? Okay. So what are some of the themes? Oh, if you have the notes, it says, what kind of Messiah is he? I'm not going to answer that for you today. That's for you to deal with this week. It's kind of like homework, except I'm not going to ask you about it next Sunday. So what are some of the ideas and themes and images we're meant to understand from this passage? Well, first of all, the story begins when it happens, 6 days later. And the later refers to 6 days after Jesus predicted his death. Jesus took Peter and the two brothers, James and John, and led them up a high mountain. 6 days. Right away, we're meant to recall the mystery of creation as told in Genesis, where God and the nurturing spirit of God are present. And God's first act of creation is to speak light into the world. And then we learn where it happens, on the mountain. In Psalm 99 that Chris read, we learn that Israel was to worship God at his holy mountain. Elsewhere in the Bible, we learn that the mountain is a place where people encounter God. At different points in Israel's history, key biblical characters heard God speak when they were led to a mountaintop. Others, such as Hagar, heard God speak to them in the desert. Moses and Elijah, in particular, both encountered God in dramatic fashion on a mountain. The mountaintop is a place apart, separate from normal everyday concerns. The desert can be that place too, and perhaps that's why God imparts important information there. These are the only places we are actually listening. So we have the when and the where, and now it's time for the what. As the men watched, Jesus' appearance changed so that his face shone like the sun and his clothing became dazzling white. As strange as that is, equally amazingly, Moses and Elijah appear and begin to have a conversation with Jesus. The Greek word in the transfiguration story that is translated as changed, as in his appearance changed, is metamorpho, as in his appearance metamorphosed. And that same word, metamorpho, is found in Romans 12:2, where it reads, "Don't copy the behavior and customs of the world, but let God transform or metamorpho you into a new person by changing the way you think." Also in 2 Corinthians 3:18, "But we all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed or metamorphosed into that same image." And I guess by now you figured out that the word metamorpho is where we get our word metamorphosis. I'm going to skip over Jesus' appearance, but I'll circle back to it and instead focus on Moses and Elijah. What are we meant to understand from the fact that they are there conversing with Jesus? Traditionally, the presence of Moses and Elijah in the Transfiguration has been understood as representing that the law and the prophets are being fulfilled in and by Jesus' life, Jesus the Messiah. Moses represents the law, and Elijah represents the prophets. But we are also meant to recall that God spoke to Moses from the burning bush. And we're also meant to recall that from the book of Exodus, that Moses spent 40 nights on the mountain engulfed in a cloud, and later, after another time on the mountain, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments, his face was radiant because he had heard God speak to him, and God's glory had passed in front of him. In Luke's telling of the transfiguration, we learn an important detail that's not in the other two. Luke tells us, tells us that Moses and Elijah were discussing Jesus' departure, which he, Jesus, was about to bring to fulfillment in Jerusalem. And the word that Luke uses that has been translated as departure in our English Bibles is the Greek word exodus. They're discussing Jesus' exodus. So perhaps the disciples and us are meant to see Jesus as the one who liberates or saves his people, like Moses, continuing the amazing history of God saving or liberating his people. And Elijah's presence is significant too. Like Moses, Elijah went up to a mountain and heard God speak to him. In addition, in the second book of Kings in the Old Testament, we learn that Elijah did not die, but was taken to heaven alive in a chariot of fire during a whirlwind, a very dramatic departure or exodus. Some biblical scholars say that Elijah's ascent to heaven in the Old Testament foreshadows or predicts Jesus' own ascent to heaven. But there may be another reason Elijah is in this transfiguration scene. In the book of Malachi, which is the last book of the Old Testament, in the very last chapter of the book of Malachi, in the second to last verse, it reads, "Look, I'm sending you the prophet Elijah before the great and awesome day of the Lord arrives." That verse was written long after Elijah's departure. And there's 400 years between that verse and the time of Jesus. And during those 400 years, the idea took hold that Elijah would come again to signal that a Messiah was in Israel. And this explains why some people, even some of the disciples, wondered if Jesus was Elijah, the one signaling that the Messiah was on the way. Later, after the transfiguration, Jesus told his disciples that John the Baptist was the Elijah figure. So the Elijah appearance at the transfiguration could be unrelated to the prophecy, or it could reinforce the prophecy, sealing the deal for the disciples that Elijah had come. All of these ideas are very likely, and there doesn't have to be just one explanation. But my favorite is that God, loving his son Jesus so much, sent Moses and Elijah to Jesus, knowing that Jesus needed to be supported and strengthened about his own imminent exodus. And who better than Moses and Elijah? I'm pretty sure that during this fantastic scene where Jesus shines like the sun and his clothes glow white while he talks to Moses and Elijah, the disciples weren't thinking any of these lofty theological thoughts. The scene unfolds as if the disciples are not even there. Peter, James, and John seem ignored or forgotten. Peter speaks up, trying to figure out why he, James, and John are there. "Best be useful. Lord, this is wonderful. If you want me to, I'll make 3 shrines right here, right now. One for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Poor Peter. In one of the commentaries on this passage that I read, the author wrote, "Imagine having 3 of the greatest figures of all time materialize before your eyes, and all you can think to say in response is, 'Can I get you a chair?'" Notice that everyone ignores Peter. And in fact, while he's still talking, or blurting out, as our translation said, he's interrupted by a bright cloud and a voice from the cloud. "This is my beloved son, and I'm fully pleased with him. Listen to him." This cloud is significant too. It's meant to remind us of the cloud that guided the Israelites as they wandered in the wilderness, that God's presence was with the Israelites. The cloud was also with Moses on the mountaintop, God's presence with Moses. And these poor disciples are so terrified that they fall to the ground and hide their faces. And then it's over. Jesus comes over and he reaches down to touch them. "Get up," he says. "Don't be afraid." I imagine him as being very thoughtful at this, and also very matter of fact. No, wow, how crazy was that, huh, guys? I love the next line. "And when they looked, they saw only Jesus with them." They must have been so relieved. Things are back to normal. And as they walk down the mountain, Jesus tells them, commands them even, "Don't tell anyone you have seen until I, the Son of Man, have been raised from the dead. So many images and themes in this event, Jesus transformed. The presence of the Trinity, which is signified by Jesus' transfigured face, the voice from heaven, and the cloud. The recollection of God's law and his revelation through the prophets. The reminders of God's redemption of Israel in the past while pointing forward to the cross. The communion of the saints, and so much more. So we're going to take a little bit of a breather here, and we're going to look at some art. I enjoy what we learn from different artistic renditions of biblical stories. Sometimes I gain insight into the scriptures. Sometimes I gain insight into the culture that produced the art. I look for what is emphasized, what is not emphasized, what is there, and what is not there. So we'll have our first one. This comes from the Eastern Church. We're the Western side of the break between the churches. This is the Eastern. I apologize for this image, the fuzziness of it. But notice, you can see the figures. It's Elijah on the left, Jesus in the middle, obviously, Moses on the right. Moses is almost always holding Ten Commandments. Peter on the lower left, he's always the older man when the disciples are portrayed. John, you can tell because he's beardless. He was the youngest disciple, and James in the middle. And as we go through some of these images, I would like you to look at the disciples individually by name to see which way they're facing. This one shows us the mountain that Elijah stood on, the mountain that Moses stood on, and the mountain that the transfiguration happened. So that helps us remember about the other guys up on the mountain. And then you see that shape behind Jesus. It's more ovally or egg-shaped, but if you'll go to the next slide, it's meant to be that portion in the center. So whenever you see that shape, and it's almost only in art from the eastern part of the church, you're meant to immediately know this is a place where heaven and earth meet. So that almond shape or fish shape bit in the center is called a mandorla, which is Latin for almond, or a vesia piscis, which is, mandorla is Italian, or vesia piscis, which means something about a fish. So let's go back to the first one. And only two people in Eastern art are ever portrayed with a mandorla behind them, Jesus and Mary, because for 9 months, Mary carried heaven and earth. Okay, let me see if there's something else I want to say about that. So the mandorla represents where heaven and earth meet, Jesus as the temple, Jesus who tabernacled among us, divine and human. Okay, let's go next slide. And yeah, that one. Okay, you can zone out if you want. I like this stuff, but it's not a big deal. All right, and I don't have a pointer, which would make me feel so cool. All right, whatever you see a mandorla, there's something else you should see. You should recognize a triangle that's formed by the two by the mandorla. So you see the dot at the upper, in the middle of where the two circles meet. Then you follow that line straight down to the lower left side of the one circle, cuts across the middle, touches the bottom of the mandorla, goes up. So you see that giant triangle. Whenever you see a mandorla, you should also recognize that the Trinity is present, Father, Son, and Spirit. And one more thing, which we're not going to, is, okay, there's a triangle on the top, and there's a triangle on the bottom. That forms a diamond shape, right? And you can see there's four points, one at the top, one on the, oh, awesome! Okay, the middle point on the left, the middle point, center bottom. Okay, got it? Diamond shape. Just remember that shape. Diamond shape, 4 points. Okay, next slide. The mandorla, or the vesia piscis, also appears in architecture and in churches especially, because we're supposed to remember, we're supposed to know, a church, this room, is a place where heaven and earth meet. So it's in architecture. One more architecture one. Yeah, in churches. The place where heaven and earth meets. All right, next slide. Yeah, this is from the Renaissance time. It's from the Western church, so we don't see a lot of symbolism, do we? We see a story. It's the story. There's Moses on the left, Jesus in the middle, Elijah on the right. Can you tell from the disciples who's who? Who do you think's on the far left?
John.
Who's on the far right? Very good. James is in the center. See which way they're all facing? Okay. And the first one we saw was an icon, which is meant to be part of, used in worship. This is on the doors of the baptistry in Florence, with a million other scenes from Scripture. Okay, next slide. This is also, this is more modern than it looks. It's from the 1900s. But Moses on the right with a book, Elijah on the left. Where's Peter? Lower left. John? Right. James? I love this one because there's a couple reasons. One is John looks like he's so scared he's actually diving off the mountain. And this is one of the few images that also, the mountain's not bare. There's actually foliage on the mountain, so I kind of like that. Okay, next image is our last one. Remember, I wanted you to think of see the diamond and the four points. Okay, so the number four in icons means the four evangelists, or it means earth. So we have two like diamonds overlapping each other, which give us 8 points, which I wanted to bring to your attention, because in Luke's gospel, this event happens 8 days later, not 6 days later like it does in Matthew and Mark. And so Luke is trying to tell us that 8 is the number of completion. Something new has happened. Creation took 7 days. Now we are in a new creation. And so that's what that icon also is adding to the whole idea of the mandorla, the Trinity. Okay, I think I'm done with our art history lesson. Okay, so art and architecture do help convey truth. Perhaps the next time you see a fish or an almond or a pointed arch, you might recall the Transfiguration. Heaven and earth meeting in Jesus, symbols of a spiritual reality where the ordinary is a threshold to the extraordinary. When I was thinking about this message, and I have to say that being on the teaching team is fun. It also feels like a huge responsibility to bring the word to you. But because I'm only up here like every 6 weeks, I have a lot of time to think between messages. And so lots of stuff while you're thinking about it pops in, you know, in life around you. Serendipitous things happen. Well, I happened to hear somewhere the word penumbra. It's usually used in astronomical context. Penumbra is the space of partial illumination between complete shadow and full light. And when I heard that word, I immediately thought of this story, the Transfiguration, because I pictured the space between Jesus and the disciples. Yes, he is illuminated, but they are not in complete darkness. They are within the penumbra. If we could see them from Jesus' point of view, see, we're on the other side of this. But if we could see them from Jesus' point of view, we would see that light from Jesus reflecting off of them. The light that shone from him reached their faces, so that they too were illuminated by the divine presence. One more slide if you feel like filling in your notes. There was no need for Peter to set up tabernacles or shelters, because the disciples themselves are meant to become tabernacles, portable holy shrines of the divine presence. The disciples were meant to mirror and pass on the mystery of God to others. Though the change appeared to take place in Jesus, the true change was to happen in the disciples. They were being transfigured by love. Of course, the disciples at this point, they're not ready for all of this. They still have much to learn about what kind of Messiah Jesus is, as do we. But this event will shape their discipleship from now on. Our third lectionary reading was written by Peter, a witness of this event. It's from 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 to 4a, and then 16 through 19. As we know Jesus better, His divine power gives us everything we need for living a godly life. He has called us to receive His own glory and goodness, to share in the divine nature. And by that same mighty power, He has given us all of His rich and wonderful promises. For we were not making up clever stories when we told you about the power of our Lord Jesus Christ and His coming again. We have seen His majestic splendor with our own eyes. And He received honor and glory from God the Father when God's glorious, majestic voice called down from heaven, "This is my beloved Son. I am fully pleased with Him." We ourselves heard the voice when we were there on the holy mountain. And because of that, we have even greater confidence in the message proclaimed by the prophets. Pay close attention to what they wrote, for their words are like a light shining in a dark place until the day Christ appears and His brilliant light shines in your hearts. Peter's trying to tell us that everything that goes into a life of pleasing God has been miraculously given to us by getting to know personally and intimately the one who invites us to God. The disciples did learn what kind of Messiah Jesus was and is. They were transfigured by love. We're not here today to simply learn about the transfiguration. We're here to open ourselves up to metamorphosis, to be transformed ourselves. We are transfigured when our understanding of Jesus grows and changes, when we respond to His gifts of grace and mercy, when we respond to the reality of His love in our lives. This reality is meant to change the way we live right now. We are meant to grow more fully into the image and likeness of Jesus, to be transfigured by His love, and Jesus, by His love, provides the way. I'd like to invite the band up. In addition to talking about the transfiguration and having a barbecue, today is communion. When ordinary bread and juice become extraordinary, they become symbols of a spiritual reality, a threshold to a spiritual truth. And the reality is that we are loved beyond measure, that nothing can separate us from the love of God, that God is present in our lives in ways both mysterious and mundane, ordinary and extraordinary, that we can become partakers of the divine nature. God is in the process of recreating us. We are being rebuilt individually and corporately into a house that carries and reflects Jesus. Portable, holy shrines of the divine presence. And this sacrament of communion is part of that process. The band will start playing in a bit. And when you're ready, just walk up to either table. You can take the bread and the juice there. You can share it with someone with you there, or you can bring it back to your seat and take it when you're ready. There are gluten-free options, and the juice does not contain alcohol. All are invited to the table. Jesus said, "This is my body broken for you. Take and eat. This is my blood poured out for you, a sign of God's faithfulness to you." Let's pray. Holy God, meet us today in these ordinary elements of bread and juice. Let this be the place and time we open ourselves to your presence, to your transfiguring love, both individually and as a community of faith. We praise you for your faithfulness to us always. Amen.